I'm Wilson Lai, and you're listening to Deep Cut. On Deep Cut, we compare a director's most popular film with a personal favorite chosen by one of us. We also discuss that director's life and career to bring in context that helps us view their movies as they may want us to. This is a special bonus summer movie diary from me. If you haven't listened to the full summer movie roundup where Eli, Ben, and I talk through our summer movie watching, stop this now and go listen to that one first. And then you can listen to me drone on for an hour and a half about the movies that I saw this summer. There will be a list of the films that I watch in the description of this episode.
And as always, if you like the show, please remember to give us a rating or review and subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also check us out on Twitter and Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd at Deep Cut Pod. And if you want to talk about movies that we cover on the podcast and anything else, you can join us on our Discord server, to which you'll find a link in the description above or below. Or, yeah, whatever. The episode description.
Without further ado, here are my summer movie diaries.
Hi, everyone. This is Wilson, and this is the start of my summer film log. It is currently June 3rd. I have just arrived in Europe after a long-ass flight from Hong Kong. It is my first time outside of the city in 2 years, and I'm excited to see a lot of friends I haven't seen, travel to a lot of places that I've never been to before, and hopefully watch some movies along the way, but maybe not. I'm on holiday, so let's see. So on this long flight, I saw three films. I saw this anime film directed by Takayuki Hirao called Pompo the Cinephile. I saw it on the in-flight entertainment and was interested in it after seeing some people rate it highly on Letterboxd. It's a very lovely film about fake Hollywood called Nyollywood and this guy who wants to make the movie of his dreams, and I think it speaks a lot to movie making, the Hollywood industry as interpreted by a Japanese director, and it is really heartwarming. And I think if like anyone who wants to be a writer director, we should definitely check this out because it's a really interesting take on it, and I think there's a lot of neat filmmaker jokes inside of it. The second movie that I watched is a classic that I've never seen before. It is Roger Mitchell's Notting Hill, starring the beautiful Julia Roberts and the charming Hugh Grant. I enjoyed this quite a lot. I feel like of course you're gonna enjoy this. This is like a late 90s, early 2000s rom-com, and I feel like that's the era in which they were doing it so well. And like when you have Hugh Grant in a role in a rom-com, you can't say no. You can't say no at all. And I think the romance is laid out really well. And I think the performances are great. And the chemistry is quite unmatched. And the last film that I saw on this flight, and probably my favorite film on this flight, was Adam Robitel's Escape Room Tournament of Champions. So this is the sequel to the first Escape Room movie that I didn't see. So this was just like a pick on the in-flight entertainment that I just wanted to watch because I'm a big Taylor Russell fan from Waves, even though I didn't enjoy Waves. I thought she was the best part of Waves. And she is incredible in this movie. But what I really loved about this movie is how they really just launched into action set piece followed by action set piece until the film's ending. This film did not stop delivering on its action beats. My heart was thumping the entire, like, 85-minute runtime, and It was incredible. I encourage you to watch it. I think people would just throw this away as like a trashy action flick. Yeah, it can be trashy, but I admire the many creative ways that they show these people in these escape rooms and the many creative ways that they try to get out of it. And there's no need to put so much exposition or backstory, and it's just a fun, wild time. Good evening. It is July 1st. Lol at the fact at me earlier last month saying that I was going to watch a lot of movies this summer, and I didn't watch any more movies in the month of June because I was busy traveling and sadly didn't even get to go to any theaters in the countries that I visited. But now I have touched down. I'm in New York City, and this month I'm going to watch a shit ton of movies. So on the flight over from Europe, I caught two movies. I watched Nora Ephron's You've Got Mail, which was awesome. I thought it was really, really great. Compared to Notting Hill, I think the screenplay is a lot tighter. The direction is also a lot tighter. You can feel an authorial voice there. I think Tom Hanks gives a really great performance in it, and Meg Ryan is so lovely in this, and I think my only gripe with this is that it's really hard to buy this romance at the end of it because Hanks is such a horrible guy in this, and like him, the big conglomerate bookstore winning in the end, feels like not the right choice to make, but I don't know. Yeah, still a classic, and I'm glad I still caught it. And the second movie that I caught on this flight was Mass, and Mass is directed by Fran Kranz. It was, I know Eli and Ben talked about it a lot in the year-end episode that we did for 2021, and I'm glad I was able to finally see it, and it was quite fitting to watch it on my flight into coming into the U.S. As it talks about two families getting together after like years after a school shooting, and one of the sets of parents is of one of the victims, and one of the sets of parents is of the perpetrator of the mass shooting. And it is a really heavy film, and I found myself crying through like so much of this movie. Like the guy next to me on the flight was asking me if I was okay, and I was just like, no, it's just the film. But I think it is a really important movie for everyone to watch, especially voting Americans, as I think it really clearly shows the effect that mass shootings have on families and just people in general. I'm not going to say too much more. I think that the decision to make the film really pared back stylistically and let the actors' work and the script speak for themselves was such a powerful and great choice. And I think all the performances, all four of the lead performances, are really stunning, especially Martha Plimpton, who really deserved all the awards that season. Yeah, definitely check this out if you have the chance. I've arrived in New York City. It's July 1st, and I've caught my first movie in the theater. I've moved into my sublet in Manhattan, in Kips Bay, and I went to the AMC Kips Bay because it is the closest cinema to me this morning to catch Top Gun Maverick at a not quite empty, but nearly quite empty cinema. So maybe, is it the movie that will save cinemas this summer? Who knows? Maybe not. But I really enjoyed it. I think Tom Cruise still has the chops to be an action leading man. I think the script was simple enough to let the action scenes really like fly and speak for themselves, and I think the action scenes are well placed within the plot to sort of up the stakes until the final mission that they have to achieve. I thought it was really funny that they never named their enemy in the film, and they just like left it for us to decide which global superpower this evil villain is. I think all the new cast of characters, Miles Teller, Glenn Powell, are all great. They look so good. I don't know how they got their bodies into that shape for those like volleyball scenes, but I am not complaining. And yeah, Top Gun Maverick, movie of the year. Who knows? It is July 4th. Happy July 4th weekend, everybody. I am in New Jersey, and I just caught Elvis with my aunt at a local theater. And it was a packed screening, and contrary to, I guess, popular belief or Letterboxd belief, this is actually a great film. It is, I think, after years of having the worst musical biopics ever, like Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocketman, which was not terrible, but I just think the problem with these movies is that they are not creatively inspired. And even though they're about artists, they feel so bland. But of course, all it takes is an auteur. And Baz Luhrmann stuck to his guns and made Elvis, which is a balls off the wall, coked up portrait of Elvis's life. I think the transitions all work. The editing is crazy and keeps you on your toes. The cinematography is so off the wall. Like, I think this sort of maximalism when it comes to movies about these pop stars works. And I think Austin Butler's performance holds everything together so beautifully. I think he has such an important job to sort of hone everything in, because the Baz is like creative, like visually, stylistically going on all these tangents and going like bouncing off the walls. It is up to Austin Butler's Elvis to keep us grounded and to keep our emotional focus through this movie. And I think he does an incredible job. It is July 5th, and I am at the cinemas again. I returned to New York City and went to IFC Center, where they were still playing RRR. I am so happy I got to rewatch this on the big screen. We will definitely be having an episode on this Rajamouli epic. So I'm not going to say too much, but 5 stars, one of his best. We will talk about it soon.
It is July 7th, 2022. I'm Eli.
I'm Wilson.
Together!
At last!
Wilson is on his Wilson Live World Tour 2022, yeah, and stopping in New York for July, mm-hmm, the first of many movies to come this month.
Exactly.
We saw Lost Highway
by David Lynch.
And now we're sitting on top of the Francesca Biel Theater.
So what did you think of the movie, Eli?
So it's interesting. I really love The Return, as Wilson and Ben have heard all too much of. And in both Inland Empire and Lost Highway, which I believe are the two movies that most recently precede The Return, if I'm not wrong, they're elements of what makes The Return feel so special to me, but I don't feel as emotionally engaged, at least on first viewings, for both of them. This is, by design, that it is so distanced. And I'll admit that I fell asleep in a couple points.
Me too.
Yeah, okay.
Unfortunately, I think it was a little bit of the jet lag that I'm experiencing.
I'd be willing to visit it again down the road. There are things that I really like. The music.
Mm-hmm.
The lighting.
I think the music,
the cinematography are also the high points for me. But I felt a bit lost, like, through a lot of it. And I think, like, of course, I think David Lynch is coming from a place where he doesn't want you to get everything that he's putting on screen.
Yeah.
And it's all about your feeling, like, your how you feel while watching this. And definitely I felt uncomfortable a lot of the time, but I think my confusion led me to not connect as much, like, viscerally, not even emotionally, but viscerally to what was happening. Because I'm like, yeah, I can see these horrible things are happening, but I'm like, I like, things are not, like, clicking in my mind. And I think that was, like, the block for me personally.
I think that's a good way to put it, because when Lynch works really well, to me, it is a very visceral feel. It is a very visceral feeling, particularly of terror and dread.
Yeah.
Those very in-the-body feelings of not understanding something, it can still be emotionally engaging in that sense, and mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily feel that on this watch.
Yeah. But yeah, those are quick thoughts on Lost Highway. We caught the 4K restoration that's playing at Lincoln Center.
Very pretty.
Yes. And we'll catch you soon.
Talk soon.
Hey everyone, it's Wilson. It is July 10th, and I just got out of a screening of Project A Part 2, which I saw at Nighthawk Prospect Park, and it was one of those, I guess, special secret Hong Kong movies where you go in and you don't know what they're going to play, and they play an old Hong Kong movie. And this is a Jackie Chan directed action movie. It's a sequel to original that I did not see. It has Jackie Chan and Maggie Cheung in it. I think the action scenes are obviously really great. I think this suffers from some plot issues. I think there was a lot of chunks of this that don't have action that I was quite not quite in the mood for. But I think the action scenes make up for a lot of that. Yeah, it was a fun watch. Still July 10th, I saw a movie with a couple new friends and an old friend as well. This is Hideaki Anno's Ritual, which he made in 2000. I think it was one of his live-action movies. I'm not quite familiar with his filmography, so this is my first Anno thing. I've heard really good things about Evangelion, so I will definitely check it out. And this sort of wrecked me, and I don't really have the words to describe why and how it does, but I think the character's relationship with the camera and with each other and making that connection was really strong and, like, affected me really deeply, and it's really dark as well. I'm sort of at a loss for words, but definitely check it out if you're into weird movies about disillusionment and filmmaking. It is July 11th. I caught the new film Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, directed by Dean Fleischer Camp, with a couple friends at the AMC Kips Bay, and yeah, it was fine. It was not as good as I thought it would be. It felt really short, I think. Like, I thought the conclusion was just, like, the end of Act 2, and we were, like, going on another adventure, but then the movie just ended like that. I did tear up, though, and I think Jenny Slate's voice acting is really good, as well as the other shells. Yeah. It's a little weird. This one felt a little flat for me. I'm sorry. It is July 13th, and I just got out of a screening of Akira Kurosawa's Sanjuro at Film Forum. I saw with my lovely friend Joseph Eusebio, and it was great. It was great. I really enjoyed this movie. I think that out of probably the five movies of Kurosawa I've seen, I wouldn't put it on the top two, but I would say that it's more enjoyable than Seven Samurai. just because I have a thing about Seven Samurai's length. For reference, I'm just I'm sitting next to Wilson, and I just gave him a "oh, really?" look. Yes. Oh, really? I think Mifune gives an outstanding performance in this. I didn't realize that this. Well, I feel like someone wrote this online, or someone told me in person that Kurosawa movies are comedies, and this was there were so many comedic moments in this, and there was so many like farcical aspects to the whole plot that made it so enjoyable, and you always appreciate the way Kurosawa stages and composes a scene. And I think that's no question here. The main group of heroes are 10 of them, and there's so many scenes where they're all in it together, and the way Kurosawa tells them to move within a shot and direct your eyes is so masterful, and I feel like there's just so much to learn from it. Lucky to catch on 35mm. Happy to watch it again.
Have you seen Yojimbo?
I haven't seen Yojimbo.
Okay, that's the other one with the same Mifune character.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a prequel to... to be the first movie, so I saw the second movie. But maybe, heads up, if I see Yojimbo this summer.
Great movie.
The date is July 13th, 2022. Mm-hmm. I'm Eli.
I'm Wilson.
And
I'm Justina.
Yeah. If you guys don't know, Justina makes the covers for Deep Cut, and
woohoo!
We both were, Justina and I were both really lucky to be able to catch Mad God, Phil Tippett's Mad God, which was Eli's favorite film of last year, on the big screen with Eli, and we caught it at IFC Center. Eli's talked about this film on the 2021 Best of episode, so I'm gonna go first.
And please.
I want to say that I really love this movie. I think I really appreciate. I understand Eli's appreciation for the craft that went into all these creatures and building the whole world of the film. I still like can't wrap my head around maybe at least like 10 things that were happening in the film. Like, I was like, how did this happen? Knowing that it took Tippett 30 years to make this, you can tell, because like you can tell that some sequences were filmed earlier and some sequences used CGI maybe a little bit, and like compositing with real life elements and stop motion elements. And I think that the amount of like gory horror elements really surprised me as well, and I feel like that was balanced out really like really beautifully with this really like calm score that was definitely like a highlight for me as well. Yeah, I would highly recommend people watch it and catch it in a theater near you.
Well said.
Nice. I mean, we were talking about the body in the film, and the body is something that was so easily destroyed and then regenerated, and just like the general dehumanization, or like how fleeting like life was in this film. And I feel like it was a really interesting commentary on sort of the late capitalist world we live in, and also linking like what it means to be born, and like what value does your life have. And then there's a really interesting sequence in the middle of the film that made me think about like our reproductive rights and how that sort of intersects with our labor rights as well. And also how like schizophrenic like time was in the film, and how it felt like the general arc of the film, like I felt like the goal was to sort of have the world like explode and implode on itself, and
the
like
soldier's
end
goal?
Right? Yeah, the soldier's goal.
Yeah,
who
yeah.
we were following from the beginning, and just like when the bomb stopped ticking, I was so anxious. And I just feel like that was such a good, like, characterization of time and also, like, reflective of our current political moment. That's my ramble.
There is no catharsis that comes from that goal. The bomb doesn't ultimately go off. I was thinking a lot about the structure of this movie this time around, and one of the things that occurred to me is that the closest thing to catharsis the movie gets in a climax sense is this abstract sequence that the floating caretaker causes by killing the baby that comes from inside of the soldier. So anything beautiful in this movie comes from brutality.
Yeah.
So well put.
I agree with that.
And there's an inherent pull in it because they can't exist without each other, just as the characters, which are so creative, can't exist without the cruelty of having been made and destroyed by Phil Tippett, arguably the mad god of the movie. So I'm really glad I got to watch it again with both of you. Very fun time.
Yeah.
Still one of my favorite movies. And yeah, I'll echo Wilson and say, seek it out if you can.
Go see
it. I agree.
And we'll catch you for the next movie.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Wilson from the future. I'm recording a review for a movie that I forgot to record a review of. And it was a while back, so please don't get mad at me because I don't really remember that much about it. And I can't refer to a Letterboxd review because I did not review it. And it was The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie by Louis Buñuel. And I saw it at Film Forum when it was playing there over the summer. And I really enjoyed it because I gave 4.5 stars. But I'm really racking my brain right now to remember why. I did remember having a really fun time and laughing a lot in the cinema. But I think there was really interesting blocking and framing from the images of the film that I remember. Almost, maybe I could say with 60% certainty, it is a blast. So, yeah, take my word for whatever. And I'll see you later.
It's July 15th. I just caught Fast and Feel Love at its New York, North American premiere at the New York Asian Film Festival with Eli, and I had to run right after, so I couldn't stay and record it with him. This is the newest film from Namapaul Thamrongrantanarit, and this is a director that I got into last year after seeing Happy Old Year in a theater in Hong Kong and really loving it. So I caught his film Die Tomorrow and 36 prior to this and have been a big fan of those two. And this feels like a weird change in course for him. There was a Q&A after the film, and I think he himself described this as a change in his career, sort of a reflection of entering his middle age. It is really funny. I think its movie references are really great. Got a lot of laughs out of the crowd and from me as well. I am interested in seeing his more commercial approach to things. I'm excited to see what he does next, but this wasn't like a home run or as effective as his previous works were emotionally for me. It is July 18th, 2022, and I just finished watching this year's film directed by Adam and Aaron Nee. I guess they're brothers, called The Lost City. It is a prime rom-com starring Channing Tatum and Sandra Bullock. This is a movie I started on the plane, enjoyed it a lot, or enjoyed it decently enough that I felt the need to finish it today. I had 20 minutes left, so it was just the conclusion. I think the gags are really good in this, and I'm still happy that
there's room or there's space for classic early 2000s-esque rom-coms in the modern day movie sphere. And I guess I was really worried about streaming and superhero movies taking away space from mid-budget studio comedies or mid-budget American films. But this is a good example of a post-pandemic rom-com that works and is riveting. Daniel Radcliffe is also really great in this. So if this is your speed, check it out.
It is July 19th, and I just got out of a theatrical screening of Tsai Ming-liang's Goodbye Dragon Inn. This is a movie, this was actually the first Tsai Ming-liang film that I ever watched. So it was my introduction to him. And after seeing many of his other films, I'm returning to this as it is meant to be seen in a theater. And oh, what a fucking picture. I love the way that this film looks on the big screen. I love the interactions that it shows. I think no one conveys loneliness like Tsai does. The rain beating down outside of the theater at the end. It's so many images are sticking with me. And it's just vibes. He's operating not on dialogue so much of the time. And just feelings and filling his long takes with so much emotion with just minimal or controlled action. Still a master of staging and framing. I really want to cover Tsai on the pod and hope we get to soon.
It is July 20th and I just got out of a documentary screening of Fire of Love, the new film by Sarah Dosa, distributed by Neon, I think, I'm pretty sure. I am generally pretty underwhelmed by this film, even especially because I've heard really, really great things about the film. I went in expecting or thinking that the scope of the film would be a lot larger than what was covered. I really appreciated and enjoyed Miranda July's narration, though. I think that was a good anchor to a story. And I understand that, I guess, the amount of clips is limited to the amount that they shot. And I guess it's really fascinating to see the filmic choices that were made by these scientists, even before knowing that this would be screened to thousands or tens of thousands of people. Interesting framing, a beautiful story behind the picture. Yeah.
Hi, this is Wilson from the future again, and I am coming back around to deliver this quick audio log on Miami Vice by Michael Mann, which I saw on July 21st at the Metrograph, and I had a great time. It was very hot. Gong Li is a treasure. I'm still a little unfamiliar with Mann's filmography, but I'm enjoying everything that I have seen so far, especially Black Hat, but this was also engaging, and I appreciate his contributions to the action genre.
It is July 22, 2022. And I just got out of a screening at AMC Kips Bay. It's a very late night screening with my dear friend Gio of the new Jordan Peele movie, Nope. And it was incredible watching something so highly anticipated on opening night. And I think Nope did not disappoint. Okay, maybe it sort of did, but I think it was one of the better American movies that I've seen this year so far, and even though I do think it sort of isn't able to reach the highs of Peele's feature debut, Get Out, I do think it's a stronger film than Us, and I think what makes this film really good is the sibling relationship
at the heart of it, the siblings played by Kiki Palmer and Daniel Kaluuya. But that's also one of the things that I wish I saw more of. Because it's the heart of the film, I wish Peele spent more script time and also screen time strengthening that relationship and showing us why they're such a good team, even before bringing all the other team members into this film. But still, a joy to watch, especially with a big crowd. Hi everyone, it is August 30th, and I have returned to Asia. I'm going to quickly talk about three films I saw on my flight. I love plane movies, and I do think we should have a bonus episode on plane movies, because they are really interesting, and I feel like it is a liminal space where, I don't know, you could just sort of watch semi-trashy movies. Not to say that any of these are trashy, but the three movies I saw were quite an eclectic group of films. I saw Howard Hawks' The Big Sleep, which is made in 1945, which surprisingly I really didn't enjoy as much as I thought I would. I think the plot is too confusing, is way too confusing. It's too many things are happening there that don't really need to happen for a noir. Yeah, I feel like it needs to be clear enough to follow in order to track, like emotionally track our main character and his feelings. But Lauren Bacall is such a standout in this film, and there's a reason that she was a massive star in her day. So the second film that I saw, which was the highlight of my flight, which was Ringo Lam's Full Alert. So Ringo Lam made this in 1997. It stars one of my favorite Hong Kong actors, Lau Ching Wan. And it is basically an intense cop versus crime lord film. And it is boiled down, it is visceral, it's angry. Ringo Lam directing our emotions into anger is one of the most effective things he does. This is something that I've seen in the only other Ringo Lam film that I have seen, which is School on Fire, which I think perfects this, but in Full Alert is another really great example of his getting us to not just sympathize but empathize with the overall anger we have at society. So the last film that I saw, and it was such a joy to watch this on the flight, was Josh Greenbaum's film from last year, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. What can I say? It's hilarious. It's joyous. The ladies at the center of this, Kristen Wiig playing a double role, and Annie Mumlow. It was great. It was great. It was so much fun, and I think it was better than what I expected it to be. And Jamie Dornan is maybe better than Channing Tatum at playing a rom-com hunky lead. Okay, Wilson out. Hi everyone, it is August 14th and I just got out of screening of the new film starring Lea Thompson, Good Luck to You, Leo Grand. I really enjoyed this. I think it was quite light, but I really appreciated how bottle episode-y it felt, as most of the scenes took place in the hotel room that her character shares with a sex worker that she begins to see in order for her to open her sexuality up. And it was very lovely. I think it covered a topic that I haven't seen in popular cinema before. And I think the compositions, the framing was really impressive. It's August 19th, and I just watched Hong Sang-soo's 2012 film starring Isabelle Huppert, In Another Country. And his other film with Huppert, Claire's Camera, is one of my favorite films of all time and my favorite Hong Sang-soo film. So I sort of had semi-high hopes for this, and this film did not disappoint. I really appreciate the lightness and the airiness that Huppert brings to Hong cinema. I think
there's a sort of carefree attitude that becomes applied to his films when she enters. And I think all the language barrier and translation stuff is really comedic and very, very fun to play around with. And it seems like a great exercise for both of them, because Hong is also working in this, I guess it's a triptych structure, but I think grounding it in a concept of a girl writing different screenplays to get her mind off of a tense situation that's happening in her real life, and imagining different situations with a French woman visiting this quiet beach town a few hours away from Seoul, called Mohang. Every time that the story restarts in classic Hong fashion, I like that there is meaning and thought behind it, in that I am thinking about, oh, this girl is rewriting, this girl is making another draft of her script. It really adds a airiness to the film that I really appreciate. It is August 22nd, 2022, and I just watched Eric Rohmer and Rosette's Adventures of Rosette, which was made in 1983. Ever since we recorded our Rohmer episodes, I've been like semi-dipping my toes back into Rohmer little bit by little bit. And this was a really lovely, even though maybe minor, addition to his filmography. But I think a great melding of the minds between him and Rosette, a collaborator, an actress of his that I guess he's been drawing inspiration from. And so the stories are based on her life and her escapades during a summer. And it feels very loose, but I think it is supposed to be, because they were intended to be different short films and not put together in this one anthology. Like, I compare this to Rohmer's Rendezvous in Paris, which feels a lot more lasered in or focused. Focused is the word. So the five stories here, some have greater impact than others, but I always love how much wackiness Rosette brings to the plot. She is sort of like a wild card character whenever she comes up in situations. And I love how she gets herself into a problem and then gets herself out of a problem. It is really charming. And also getting to see regular Rohmer collaborators and players like Marie Reverie, Pascal Gregory, Maria Luis Garcia just reappearing in these different shorts is really charming. It is the same date as August 22, 2022, and I just watched a documentary by Man Lim Chung called Keep Rolling, and this documentary is a portrait of one of my favorite directors of all time, An Hui. I just drafted up a really, really long review on Letterboxd, so if you want to hear what I have to say about this movie in written form, it's up there right now. But in long story short, it is a great movie, and I think one of the best director biopics out there. It not only paints a portrait of An Hui as an artist, but also An Hui as a person who's willing to admit that she's made some mistakes in her life and in her career. And I think the humbling nature of this portrait of her makes me like her even more. And I think the intimacy that Man Lim Chung gets with her, because he worked as her production designer on Our Time Will Come and followed her and interviewed her afterwards and during the press tour of that movie, you just get a truer sense of who she is. And I think there's also some really interesting things that are being said at the end of this film about the state of the Hong Kong film industry and its place in the world. Yeah, so this is a highly recommended film for me. And if you want to learn more about An Hui, if you've seen a few of her movies, this is a great place to get more information. If you have never heard of her before and you want a primer on her, this is also a great starting point. It is August 23rd, and after watching a biopic of a Hong Kong director, I decided to choose another film about a Hong Kong director to watch the next day. And this is a shorter film. It is less than an hour long. So this is Ferris Lin, who directed a feature on the work and life of Johnny To called Boundless that I watched in research for our Johnny To episode. Shout out to that Johnny To episode. Go check that one out. It's really early in our run, but it is one of my favorites. And this is The Weaving of a Dream, Johnny To's vision and craft. And this is Ferris Lin's behind-the-scenes documentary about the making of 3. I guess you shouldn't watch this if you haven't watched 3, but I watched 3 and wanted to see how they pulled off a lot of stuff, and especially that long take at the end, and this did not disappoint. The way that this man works is crazy. Johnny To and his screenwriter, Yeo Na Hoi, write the script while on set. So there's a lot of this film showing the actors just waiting because To and Yao were not able to crack a plot problem. And it is insane watching them trying to work under so much pressure. I think I would literally die if that was in that situation. It is still the 23rd of August, and I just watched probably one of my favorite new watches of this summer. It is a short film by Japanese director Naomi Kawase called Katatsumori, and it was made in 1994. She filmed this when she was still 24 years old, and it's incredible. I love this movie so much. It is about her and her relationship with her grandmother, and it's basically a collection of home video of her interacting with her grandmother and just talking about life and when she was younger. And yeah, it really spoke deeply to me, and it will remain a movie that has a really special place in my heart, and hopefully will return to over and over again. So lovely. So lovely. Please check this one out. August 24th, just saw Broker on the big screen. Very good, very good. Feels like classic Koreeda. We'll wait till a Deep Cut Upkeep episode to talk more. Just saw an early Naruse film from 1935 called The Actress and the Poet. If you don't follow me on Letterboxd, I've been doing this really slow and long-term project of going through Naruse's whole filmography. So this was just one film in this, and probably one of my least favorite or weakest from Naruse's output that I've seen so far. It is a comedy. I think this is like either his second or his third sound film, so I feel like he's still getting used to telling stories with dialogue and venturing into genre territory that probably he didn't feel super comfortable with, and I guess didn't really return to that much later in his career. This is a comedy about neighbors, basically, different households, and gender roles in the household, which is, I guess, a theme that he plays with in most of his career, but leaves a lot more to be desired. And I think, like, if you were to watch Naruse, do not start with this one. It is August 29th, and I just watched Owen Klein's directorial debut, Funny Pages, and had a blast, really. I didn't really have that high or low expectations going in, and sort of just chose this movie on a whim, but it is so grimy that I can't keep on going in this review without explaining that this is so gross, and really goes for it and wants to make you feel so uncomfortable watching it. And I think it achieves it, like goes to the moon and back and achieves that. The characters are horrible to each other. They're horrible people. And I think it makes you feel so icky inside that I can't not commend it for what it does. And like, even if I come out of a film and I don't feel good, that's not my litmus test for if I like or how highly I rate a movie. It's always the amplitude of what feeling the movie elicits from me. And this was pretty high on that. So definitely check that out if you're in for a horrible time.
Hi, this is Wilson from the future here, recording another review for a movie that I missed this summer. This is a movie that I saw on August 30th, 2022, so it was around the end of my summer, and it was Mike DeLeon's early film, Moments in a Stolen Dream, starring the incredible Hilda Coronel and Christopher DeLeon. This is a genre movie, it's a romance film, a young love film that looks scrumptious. It is such a beautiful looking film, and you can tell that Mike DeLeon was a cinematographer first because the colors in this, the compositions, the zooms, it feels so intentional, even though I feel like there was a really easy way out of how this movie could be directed. I think the camera work really elevates this to another level. Yeah, check this out. It is August 30th, and I just saw Anh Hui's All About Love, the 2010 movie about a lesbian and a bisexual woman falling back in love in Hong Kong. I really love this. I think this approach to queer storytelling is so unique and, I don't know, so novel. I feel like you take a lot of things for granted, but I have to remember that this was made in 2010 and how forward-thinking this was in presenting and revealing a modern queer family where all parties involved are open and willing and happy to contribute. It feels so much more in tune with local Hong Kong culture of the time than I would say maybe even like a Happy Together, which speaks to something a little more universal, but this works better on understanding local Hong Kong culture more. So I would highly recommend this.
Hi everyone, this is Wilson. It is August 30th and I just watched Patrick Tom Gaming's Love Massacre, which was made in 1981, stars Bridget Lin. And this might be one of my favorite movies that I've seen this summer. It is a slasher film. I don't want to give a lot away because a lot hinges on the twists and the violence, the unexpected violence that happens in this film. But this sense of eeriness, this sense of detachment and this sense of loneliness Patrick Tam imbues this film with is what, in my opinion, is his idea of what it is like to live in America as an immigrant from Hong Kong. And I think the violence that is allowed in this film is harrowing, but also the way that it's presented is so gorgeous. There's so many simple frames, simple color work in the production design, the blown out whites of the frame make everything feel so sterile and so unwelcoming, and I just am so blown away by how visceral this film is and how out there it is. This is my third Patrick Tam film that I've seen. I'm definitely going to go down the rabbit hole and watch through his entire filmography because this was incredible. And I implore everyone to go find this movie.
I don't know. Yes. And watch it. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I'm going to do the outro. Thank you for listening to this episode of Deep Cut. Please rate and review because that helps us keep making the show. Be sure to subscribe to us where you listen to podcasts so you'll know when our next episode drops. You can keep up with Deep Cut on Twitter and Instagram. Join us to talk about movies on our Discord server, to which you'll find a link in the description. Thank you to Justina Yam for our beautiful artwork. I am Wilson, and we are looking forward to talking about more movies with you next time. Take care.